Hello and welcome to Gribbing in the Filth with me, Tom Sharp. It may not surprise you to hear that making a podcast about invertebrates is not my full-time job. Naturally, I'd urge you all towards buymeacoffee.com/gribbingcast, but until you all see fit to bang a few thousand pounds my way, I'm not going to be able to put food on the table by chatting about invertebrates on a podcast. I suppose when it comes to podcast topics, invertebrate life is not as rewarding an avenue as more marketable and socially acceptable topics, such as actual serial killers or men's rights activism. So when I'm not thinking intensely about wasps and crabs and so on, I'm a teacher. And would you believe it, when you're a teacher who's fond of invertebrate life, you often find yourself in a bit of a soapbox. Teaching is about building a love of learning and about providing children with critical thinking skills and understanding and a framework by which they can continue to grow into happy and confident people. Watching enthusiasm for learning grow is one of the most rewarding parts of the job, much more rewarding than incessantly explaining nobody has hacked your Timetable Rockstars account. If I was passionate about gazelles, then bad news, they rarely show up. But invertebrates do come into our classrooms and our lives. Bees, wasps and spiders do come to visit the classroom, and yes, it causes a real fuss. Outside, we come upon ants and grasshoppers and all kinds of fun. And these interactions are opportunities for the children to discover so much about the world, so many incredible things. But regrettably and inevitably, when we want to talk about invertebrate life, we're coming up against a pretty substantial cultural barrier. And when we want to teach children about invertebrate life, it can be frustrating because we know how amazing it is, but it's so hard to overcome that distrust and fear and hatred of invertebrate animals. In today's episode, I want to talk about invertebrate education, something I really care about. I want to talk about how we teach about these animals, how we celebrate them with young people, and how we make a difference. Learning about the world is a good thing. Being compassionate towards other animals is an act of moral goodness, and acknowledging that other animals have value, or the even more fundamental truth that they are animals, is important and worthwhile. Joining me to discuss invertebrate education is educator, podcaster and conservationist Jack Baker. I was really grateful to Jack, host of Pangolin, the conservation podcast, for speaking with me and sharing his own expertise in invertebrate education, which is substantial and fascinating. If you're not a teacher or a parent, or someone who has young people in their lives, I still think there's a lot to enjoy here, a lot of enthusiasm and passion for invertebrate life. Additionally, if you're not a teacher, yes, I deserve the holidays. No, I don't get paid enough. If you are a teacher, hello, solidarity, and yes, we have some things here that might interest you. Let's get into it as we talk with Jack Baker about invertebrate education. Today I'm joined by Jack Baker, conservation educator and host of Pangolin, the conservation podcast. Jack, how are you today?
I'm very, very good. Thank you so much for having me.
You're more than welcome. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I know that you've got your finger in many pies, animal-wise, many animal pies, in terms of invertebrates, in terms of not invertebrates. It's a conservation, a big conservation basket within which we find many animals. But today we are going to talk largely about invertebrates because you have a bit of a history with educating and being part of education programs, I guess you might say, and outreach, which is often crossed over with the invertebrate world. And it's a world that needs invertebrates. We know they have this public image crisis. So I'm excited to hear what you've got to say about that work. I mean, could you maybe sort of a potted history of your personal and professional relationship with invertebrate animals?
So I guess, yeah, hi everyone. I'm Jack, and yeah, my history with invertebrates is a strangely long one now. Actually, when I was kind of preparing for the podcast, I was thinking back like all the different times they've crossed into my life and career and everything in different ways. And I think I started working in an aquarium with invertebrates about almost 10 years ago now, it must be like some eight, nine. So it feels like a very, very long time. And even before that, as a child, I was always fascinated. I was always the one going up, and like whenever you went to these sort of education places and they did the kind of tarantula handling or something, like I was always the person up there trying to get involved and stuff. So yeah, a long history with them. And it kind of started professionally, I guess, when I started working at an aquarium, where I was kind of in a visitor presentation role. And there we would give talks, I think, about the stuff that kind of people usually think of when they think of invertebrates, things like kind of the creepy crawlies and stick insects and all sorts of stuff like that. And then also the kind of marine invertebrates, which was another aspect, which was exciting and interesting. Things like we had an octopus, we had starfish, crabs, all sorts of bizarre, weird, fascinating things. And then, yeah, from there, that kind of lasted for about, I think I worked there for about 4 years, maybe. Very, very long time. Oh, the last few years are all a blur, so I start to lose track. But about 4 years, I worked with those animals. Then I moved to work for the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland, where I worked at Edinburgh Zoo. And we ran I ran a summer school there for primary twos and threes.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that was, and it was great fun because it was the perfect age group where they were like, they weren't too cool for school yet. They were still there to have a good time and laugh and run around and have fun. And it was just the best time.
Maybe we should qualify. When you say primary twos and threes, what age group are we talking about?
So, oh, yes. I always forget that Scotland does things differently. So that would be about 5, 6-ish years old.
Right.
And sometimes slightly old. So it obviously varied dependent on things. Sometimes a bit younger, sometimes, yeah. But generally, that's around that sort of age group. And so, yeah, the age where they are kind of like still willing to run around, have fun, have a good time. It was almost completely derailed on day one, actually, by one very naughty and angry invertebrate, which was a wasp who decided to sting one of the children immediately as they entered the first activity that we were doing. But we got through, and then we kind of got them over that by doing different activities with things like giant African land snails and cockroaches and stuff like that. So that was kind of that era of work. And then, yeah, most recently, I kind of have been working at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, where I've been also running another summer school that was kind of focused around teaching kids about the kind of power and magic of plants. But also, of course, as part of that, plants are wonderful, they're brilliant, but they rely on invertebrates a lot of the time to survive, and they provide a home. There's kind of this beautiful symbiotic relationship there with plants and insects, where they kind of rely on each other to survive and thrive. And so, yeah, there was a lot of kind of a bug safari and stuff to kind of go and look at, yeah, different sorts of little creepy crawlies you'd find in your garden. So it's been kind of a long history. And then I should also, like, yeah, because I suppose my career would make sense up and it makes sense and works as a timeline until one point, and then it gets very confusing when I start saying things like, oh, I also still work for Edinburgh Zoo and I still work for the Botanic sometimes and all this sort of stuff. But for general listeners, if you're out there and you're confused by the timeline at any point throughout this episode, it was aquarium, then zoo, then Botanic Garden, the whole circle of life covered in that sphere of things. Yeah.
And at every stage of that, we have invertebrates knocking about. We have... We've got your starfish at the aquarium. We've got a bug safari. And at every stage, our little creeping mates are knocking about, right? Presumably talking to kids and things, invertebrates are always going to be, they're always going to be one of the things you do talk about most and that you can talk about most because of scale and because of availability and things like that. I mean, you can't necessarily experience you would have with something that can be right there in front of you in a little tank and that the kids can not necessarily touch, but that can be immediate to them, right?
Wonderful little invertebrates are always there, always doing important, amazing things. So yeah, it's funny how they have played maybe a more prominent role in my life, but they're there for us all, really.
Absolutely. And I think with that ubiquity of invertebrates, you can view that in more than one way. So for a lot of people, the fact they're always around is why they're a menace. And for other people, the fact they're always around is what's so wonderful about them. And I mean, that kind of, that thought of how we approach animals, I was really interested, I was getting ready to speak to you about that, in terms of you're a conservation educator and conservation is something that matters to you. And presumably that involves the preservation and protecting things and having quite a pragmatic approach to the life around us. And I was wondering, as someone that's been passionate about, as someone who is passionate about conservation, your relationship with animals, is it kind of, is it a pragmatic thing? And is it about protecting and yeah, pragmatic's the word, right? This a practical thing where you're trying to ensure the world continues in the way that we want it to continue? Or is your approach to animals and your relationship with animals, like as a fan, you know, as someone who likes them and therefore wants to protect them? Or is there kind of a balancing act there?
That's a really good question. It's a question I think about all the time, because it's a tricky one. And I think the way that I like to think about it is, when I was younger and watching documentaries about kind of animals with David Attenborough, whether it be kind of Africa or Planet Earth or all of these things, I just admired animals for them being them, for being unique and special. And I kind of fell in love with all of these bizarre creatures, and I fell in love with these stories that would be told to me through these documentaries or books or whatever it was. And yeah, I would say at that point when I was younger, I really loved animals. I love them, love them, love them, love them, love them. And I do still really love animals. It's the driving force behind everything that I do. I love nature and wildlife and plants and animals of all shapes and sizes. I do really, really love it. But I think at a certain stage of my life and of my career, I kind of have switched from loving animals to loving conservation. And I think it's a subtle difference. Right. And it's not to say that loving animals is bad, but I think the difference for me lies kind of in this, like, I love animals, but I want to protect the ecosystems wider than just the animals that belong in them. Because I think, I guess for a lot of people, if you love animals, you love certain animals, you love certain aspects of ecosystems, but you don't necessarily love everything. I try and love and appreciate everything that is in an environment and everything that provides those essential ecosystem services, and whether they be small or strange or bizarre or stereotypically scary or creepy or whatever it is, I try and appreciate and love them. And I guess that's where the conservation aspect kind of comes in for me, is that I want to protect all of these things rather than just select animals that I love. Yes. And I guess that also kind of sometimes means that there are difficult decisions to be made, because when you love animals, whenever an animal dies, you will be hit by it, really upset. You'll be really upset. You'll be kind of hurt by it. Whereas in conservation, sometimes you do have to make these tough choices where, for example, where does funding go? Where do you stand on controversial issues like trophy hunting or things like that? And so sometimes these controversial issues that if you loved animals, you'd fall very firmly on one side of, in conservation, you have to kind of be more pragmatic and balance the scales a bit differently. And so, yeah, that's kind of the way that I look at it, is I love conservation. And so sometimes there are difficult or strange things that we have to contend with or accept. And yeah, that's kind of where I would stand on it. Yeah. I don't know, I went on a bit of a ramble there, but I think and I hope that came out as well as it sounded in my head.
No, it certainly did. And rambling very much encouraged. It reminds me of, there's this thing, I don't know, I'm not really up on it, but have you seen this thing at the moment in the States with the spotted lanternfly?
I have not. Please tell me more. So there's
these plant hoppers. And again, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm going to have a general crack at it. And if I'm wrong, sorry. But as I understand it, they are this invasive species that's come to the States. And it's a beautiful insect, but it's really, really having a really negative impact. And the signs are going up in things saying, you know, if you see one, you've got to kill it. And it makes me think, like, and again, I don't know the details of this, so whatever, take it with a pinch of salt. But in that situation, I don't like killing things, and I wouldn't want to do that, because no individual animal has made a malicious decision to have that kind of impact and to be a problem. And yet that could be a necessary thing. So presumably within conservation, it's that thing of, like, there will be decisions for the greater good made sometimes that will have negative implications for specific animals, be it a species or an individual, and that's going to be kind of hard.
Mm. Yeah, and it's a really tricky one where you're kind of, and it's never a nice choice to have to make, and you don't envy anyone who has to make those choices. And I'm kind of very glad I'm still at the career where I'm not pulling the trigger on which species or which individuals we have to look to protect more, or we have to put more funding into, or whatever it is. But it's, yeah, it is something that you need to think about when you're interested in conservation. Is okay, you have to be ready, no matter how much you don't want to do it, you have to be ready to make a tough choice.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's especially, I guess, for you, when, because your whole world revolves around the invertebrates, they're the things that you love. They're kind of also often the ones that are considered to be pests in a lot of ways in conservation things. So that must be, it must be exceptionally hard for, yeah, when your focus is entirely on these animals that are so commonly looked at as the bad guy. Like, it's a hard one. But of course there are excellent conservation stories out there about invertebrates. So the one that springs to mind for me, I guess, to kind of flip that on its head, where we're talking about a species that's doing a bit better, things like, here in Scotland, the Royal Zoological Society is working on a pine hoverfly conservation project.
Right.
And so they're looking to kind of protect and reintroduce these hoverflies to the Highlands of Scotland that were critically endangered, almost to the point of extinction. So they're looking to kind of reintroduce those. And so, yeah, it's exciting and interesting to see that conservation does work both ways. It's not always tough choices. There are success stories to come alongside the invertebrate bad stuff as well sometimes.
If you're enjoying Grubbing in the Filth, come and wallow with me in the horrendous world of social media. You can follow Grubbing in the Filth on Instagram and Twitter. On Instagram, it's at Grubbing in the Filth, and on Twitter, it's at GITF Podcast. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, whether it's your own perspective, to share a story, a photo, or what have you. Let's talk a bit about that sense of invertebrates as the bad guy then, because presumably as someone who's educated and someone who's worked a lot with kids, when we talk about educating people about invertebrates, we're often talking about kids, and we're often talking about trying to get in at an early stage and and change the narrative and get ahead of that enormity of ill will that is felt towards invertebrate animals. You know, with the aquarium and things like that, what did you sort of see as a success when it came to talking to children about these animals?
So it's a tricky one, because success could be measured in multiple different ways for different audiences and different things. And I guess a good session for me where I felt like, oh, I've achieved something here and I've got through to them, I think can't just be, especially with kids, can't just be a kind of lecture session. I know kind of when I was doing my undergraduate degree, that's when I was working in the aquarium. And I think something that kind of impacted me was that I am not the type of learner who can sit through a 2-hour long lecture and take things in. And I think that really impacted on the way that I taught, because I feel like kids have to have that quick kind of like 15 minutes, an engaged session where they're answering questions, where they're seeing something, where they're doing something, where they're responding actively to something. They're not just sat there in silence. That to me would be a success, where they're kind of thinking for themselves, they're engaged, they're excited, they feel like they are, yeah, they're kind of involved in the moment.
Yes.
Maybe they get an encounter with one of these kind of invertebrates. Maybe they get to touch a starfish, or maybe they get to hold a stick insect, and that kind of forms that memory. And just, it's all about this engagement and getting them to break down these walls between them and the education system and them and the invertebrates, and getting them to kind of really be involved and excited by what they're seeing, I guess. And I also think at the end, something that really would to me indicate that there was a success is that there's a takeaway. There's something that they want to know, how can we help? And we're telling, and then I'm able to tell them, oh well, if you're interested, say for example, in the undersea creatures, maybe think about plastic pollution, or think about doing a litter pick, or think about doing something like that, and kind of getting them these takeaway messages that they can then go home and say, mum, dad, whoever, like, I need to do this, I need to protect this, I need to kind of, we need to look after all of these things. Like, that's kind of the things. I mean, I guess maybe the last thing, especially when it comes to invertebrates, if I was thinking about things that would indicate a success to me, would be kind of, so you've got this kind of engagement, you've got kind of this takeaway, but I think there also needs to be, at the end, this appreciation for all life, not just right. life that is big, exciting, charismatic megafauna, like they're taught in documentaries a lot of the time, life that mm-hmm. is small and bizarre and weird and kind of thought of as strange or creepy or whatever. Appreciation, even if they don't like it and they don't want to hold it and they don't want to look at it because they're a little bit frightened by it or whatever it is, an appreciation for the fact that these incredible things exist on our planet, they play important roles and they are amazing, wonderful things. That's kind of the appreciation that I'm looking for. So I guess, yeah, that would be my my three-pronged attack for a successful session would be engagement.
Lovely.
And what was it? Engagement, taking something away, and then, yeah, an appreciation for life.
Wonderful. An educational trident. It's really interesting that you say that, like, my instinct is always, I want kids, you know, I teach kids, I want them to like them. And actually, mm-hmm. that's kind of, it's a maybe an unachievable goal sometimes. And what you do want to come away with is that sense of respect or that sense of mm-hmm. of acknowledgement that, even if they don't like them, that's all right. But like, they're not villains, right? Mm. I mean, when you've been running these sessions, how often do they start with screams?
I was going to say all the time. I think it actually depends on the setting. So kids, like,
right.
in the aquarium, I think people, like when they were in like a handling session, there was the squealing and the things because they're with parents and they're kind of looking for a little bit of attention, and they were scared and they were kind of like, oh, look, and they're also kind of reading the energy of the parents. And if the parents are giving off nervous energy, then they also would feed on it. And so they kind of get this kind of like, oh, look, I'm scared. But actually, like, so it would start with that. In the garden setting, actually, though, more, I don't know whether it was just the kids that were there or the kids that kind of, because we're in an outdoor setting and the kind of creatures we were seeing were maybe smaller. They weren't kind of these big giant millipedes or giant stickets. They were these kind of smaller things. They would kind of maybe not be as frightened, but they tended to respond better. They tended to kind of want to be involved. They wanted to get like little bug boxes out and see what was going on. They didn't tend to scream as much. Of course, you had the occasional freak out about a spider or freak out about kind of, oh, look at the worm, whatever it was. Occasionally those things did happen, but it was a lot less frequent than I kind of expected it to be. And I don't know whether it was just kind of like me, obviously I taught these things 5 years, 6 years, 7 years apart, so I don't know whether it's just me growing in confidence as an educator and instilling then more confidence in the children that these things are okay to be around, or if it was the setting. It's hard for me to pin down, but like, yeah, I do think there was a difference there. And
it's interesting because what I've noticed is that for some children, and this is not to, I don't want to do down their feelings, but sometimes when kids respond to animals, mm-hmm. there is a kind of performative sense to it where like,
yeah.
it's a spider. I need to now demonstrate that I'm the kind of person that doesn't like spiders. That kind of, and they're not lying about not liking them, but there is a certain sense of, there is a way we should respond to these animals. I will now go through the motions mm-hmm. of having that response. And that's part of what we're working against. I can tell you literally my most recent piece of invertebrate education, which is in the last week, the flying ants around my school have started kicking off. And I saw these ants knocking about and I thought, and I ran back to the class. I wasn't in the classroom at the time. I was on had planning time. But I went back to the classroom. I was like, right, children, before you leave, you need to know the ants are flying. And I need you to understand a few things about that. And I need you not to hurt the ants. Because mm-hmm. there's that sense of like, I know they're going to go out and they're going to try and stamp on the ants and things. And it's going to upset me. And I'm trying to kind of have damage limitation. And when it comes to ants, what I've always found is that when I talk to children about ants and I'm able to say, right, it's flying ant day. Here's what that is. And mm-hmm. what gender do you think that ant is? And being able to tell them and being able to make ants into a thing that isn't just a... It's not just a crawling thing. It's a thing which has a, you know, I can tell you what that one is going to do with the rest of its life. I know mm-hmm. what these ants are up to. And giving them that narrative does make them more interested. Not all of them. You're not going to win them all around. But maybe they won't go and stamp on them. Maybe they'll tell their parents about them. Maybe, I don't know. But it's, I find that there is finding that narrative of what the insect is up to, what the arachnid is up to, and things like that. The kids understand through story a lot of the time, and that can be really, really helpful.
I think that's, yeah, it's exactly the thing. And it's kind of sparked a couple of examples in my head that I could throw out there and kind of like,
please do, yeah.
I guess the first one, like, to make it relevant to what you were just saying about stories and creating these, I think a great thing to do is kind of help them understand the life cycle and the kind of, yeah, that these animals live lives like any other animals. They might not be the big fluffy, they might not have the big cute round eyes, the big floppy ears, but they live these interesting, complicated lives. And I think you can kind of go that story. I also, during my last summer school, there was a Myths and Legends Day.
Right.
And so we talked a lot about, because it was focused a lot about plants, obviously a lot of the stories were of plants or of the seasons or whatever it was, but I always liked to tell the story of, well, I like to tell two stories from Greek myths about invertebrates. I liked to tell the story of Melissa, the first honeybee, who presented her honey to Zeus and was then cursed to have a stinger that would, if used, kill her. And then there was also the story of Arachne, the weaver, who took on Athena and then the goddess of arts and crafts in a weaving contest. And then when she lost, was turned into, of course, a spider. And I think those kind of like connections to myth also were kind of an engager for kids. So whether you're going for fact or kind of this fictitious but still magical, incredible, charming, charismatic story, they both kind of imbue this love of nature. Because I think, yeah, kids don't always love science, but all kids love stories. Like, they love a good story. So if you can weave that for them, they really, really enjoy it. I guess the other thing that you kind of sparked in my mind while you were chatting there was kind of this, when you go back to the classroom and you explain it to them. I think that's the one kind of teaching technique which I kind of implement most often is I am, when I'm teaching, a very lighthearted, I don't shout, I don't pull people aside and get cross at them, unless, of course, they've done something that endangers themselves or the other children or upset someone or is aggressively. But like, aside from those kind of things, I try not to be the type of teacher who is strict all of the time. And we have to do this way, exactly this way, all of the time. And we need to walk in a straight line. Because at the end of the day, when you're doing environmental education, it should be more fun. It should be more experiential. It should be more free form a lot of the time. And so, but the one time I am very strict is when it comes to the respect of nature aspect, where I kind of go, okay, we're going into this garden and we're going to be looking at insects, or we're going to be looking for little creatures that live among the kind of the undergrowth and things. If the children start misbehaving then and start looking like they're going to be throwing things around or start chasing after things and start kind of, that's when I am the one time I am strict, because I think that's really hits home. Actually, he's being serious about this now, because it is important that you teach them that these animals are fantastic and wonderful and have stories and all that stuff. But you also have to teach them this respect that you can love, like, while love is a lot, you also have to respect these fantastic, wonderful creatures, because you wouldn't like it if someone came along and all of a sudden was stomping through your house, turning over all of your things, like trying to squashing all of your family members. You wouldn't like that. So we have to like respect this and we have to kind of make sure not to. And it's, yeah, it is the one time where I'm kind of like, okay, guys, now I'm going to say something that you really have to listen to. And if there is a problem, you will face consequences for it, because we will. And the consequences are just me being like, pulling them aside and being like, don't do that. But because I never do that, they're kind of like, oh, he's talking to me seriously. That's not good. And it kind of hits home a bit harder. It's like a good cop, bad cop relationship, but I play both roles. And it seems to work quite well, I think.
I read them. I'm going to paraphrase it now, but there's like there's a really nice poem that I read somewhere. I don't know. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what it is. But the crux of the matter is, you don't get to kill something because you're afraid of it. You know, nothing deserves that. And generally speaking, kids get it and don't want to hurt things. I remember when I was a kid, I did this. Do you ever read the Horrible Science books?
I dipped in it. Yeah, those were definitely them, and Horrible Histories were everywhere in my school. Yeah.
Yeah, Horrible Histories was the big one, but there was a Horrible Science, and the author of Horrible Science, he came to like the Durham Book Fair, and he did a session about whatever, and his big, like, the finale of the show was him talking about cockroaches and how they can survive without their heads, and that's really interesting, and it's a nice story to hear, and it's interesting because of why that happens, because their brain isn't a brain in the same way that ours isn't. There's that the nervous system is kind of more decentralized, and therefore they can survive without the head for a bit. And that's really interesting. But his kind of finale was that he had a box and was like, I've got a cockroach in this box. Should we pull its head off? And some of the kids were sort of baying for blood. And there was one girl that got really upset and started crying. And it was only afterwards my dad told me, like, you know, there wasn't a cockroach in that box. Like, that was never going to happen. But even so, that's not how I'd like to bring living things into a conversation with children as a, you know, it, isn't it gross? Look at, we can do it harm because it doesn't really matter, and that kind of thing. And I'm sure that's not what he was going for, but that's kind of my memory of it. I wonder, with the kids you've worked with, when you are able to put insects in front of them, because I think you mentioned cockroaches earlier, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, because that's an insect that has, it's not a popular one. You know, ladybirds, kids like them. Bees, kids like them. Cockroaches, they're low on the list, right? When you present those animals to children that aren't necessarily the charismatic invertebrates, the starfish and things, how are you working with those particular invertebrates to talk about them, and what's your approach been there?
So that's another good, I guess for me, the thing that I would kind of say is not disagreeing, but I think is kind of like taking your point and twisting it, is I think there is a place for the gross or the strange.
Oh yeah, of course.
If not used detrimentally. Because, like, for example, when you're talking about starfish, for example, they eat in a strange, bizarre, awkward way where they kind of crawl over whatever it is. They bring kind of their kind of stomachy, intestiny bits up and envelop whatever it is that they're trying to eat, and then bring it back into their bodies. And it's all kind of, yeah, it is a bit, it's a bit, it's strange, grim. A bit, yeah, grim. Yeah. And that can be a good way of kind of making audiences be like, wow, like, it's gross, but I love it. So it's finding those, like, weird ways in. I guess it's hard because you don't want to overly humanize things, because want to, like, have people love animals just because they're like us. You don't want to kind of create this relationship. But I suppose it's breaking it down and getting them to see that actually these animals and these things aren't that different from a lot of the other stuff that we're looking at and we love. Like, there's there might be behavioral differences or size differences, or appearance wise there might look a bit creepier, a bit strange, or a bit more bizarre, but it's trying to find this way to be like, they're not that different, they're not that strange. And I don't know, I suppose a big tool for that can be kind of these animal handling sessions where kids get to see them up close. They get to kind of have a cockroach sit in their hand and realize, oh, actually, it may be big and it may be kind of intimidating looking, and it may hiss occasionally. Or that's the kind of, if it's upset, like if it is upset, then it would hiss. Then that it does these things, but those things aren't bad. And it isn't doing them to hurt me or be nasty to me. It just sits there. And same with snails, or same with, like, all of these things, stick insects, whatever it is that the kids think were gross or strange or bizarre, they're not that bad if you just experience them. So I guess, that's what I would say. Yeah, the kind of experience of it all.
You can now make donations to help offset the running costs of this podcast. If you're enjoying Grubbing the Filth and want to make a donation, like a benevolent Victorian, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/grubbingcast, where you can also write a brief message if you so wish. Any donations are truly appreciated. Thank you. Within the insects that you've, or invertebrates generally, I guess, that you put forward, there are going to be those ones, like the cockroach, like maybe like a giant snail, it's all slimy and things. Which ones are the easiest cells? Like, which ones, from the word go, are kids most kind of up for, do you think?
So, I think, actually, it's a strange distinction of kind of, like, anything that was under the sea, kids were fine with. They were fine with, like, looking at an octopus through glass, loved it. Thought it was so incredibly interesting. They loved hearing about its conservation. They loved hearing about kind of how if the octopus goes away, that affects all of the animals in the ecosystem. They loved hearing about how it has all these strange abilities to hide itself and all of that sort of stuff. They loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it. And even when it got to things that they were getting a bit more up close and personal with, things like the starfish, there was always a bit of nervousness, but there wasn't that fear necessarily that you sometimes get associated with the animals that live on land. And I don't know whether it was because the animals that we were presenting in our kind of insect sessions were larger than perhaps they were used to. They were more, there was more legs, there was more whatever it was. I don't know. So I suppose the easy cells would be things like those kind of sea creatures, where the harder cells then became the things that were perhaps they were more likely to experience, which they were more likely to see. And I don't know. It's an interesting thing that, like, you'd think the things that people were around more often or around similar things more often, they'd be more kind of like, oh, it's just a millipede. Like, we have little ones of those in our gardens or whatever it is. But it's not that. And it was strange. It was really, really strange. But, you know, once you get them to see them and you get them to see the little, like, antenna wiggling around or the little stick insect crawling up my arm and kind of making me look a bit silly because it just wants to go for a wander up my arm while I'm trying to talk all about it, or nibble on my arm hairs while I'm trying to tell them about how wonderful it is. Like, they do break down those barriers. But yeah, initially, I think that those were the ones where there was the initial kind of like, oh, I don't like that. I don't like that.
It's so basically when there's a sense of a distance and maybe almost safety from the creature, it's an easier sell, I guess. I mean, what my kind of feeling with a lot of this stuff is that it's really, really positive, and I think you've done this, to be able to take children out into wild spaces and have a bug safari or look for things and get involved with things. And I think that's like a lovely way of having them learn about things. And because these animals are always going to be immediate to them, and they can go, if they're lucky enough to have a garden, they can go and look in the garden. And it's such a nice way of having people engage with the immediate, but the undervalued, you know. What do you think, maybe you could think of some examples of like sessions that you've run or even specific interactions you've had as an educator talking about invertebrate animals. Do you have any like big successes or things that have gone particularly well?
You know that way where I'm like now scanning the database of like things of like years of presentation, like which are the ones that stand out to me, I guess?
We should establish they all went well.
They all went well. Not, there was no horrible crying or screaming or throwing of things. I guess from a personal standpoint, that one session that sticks out in my mind is actually... So there was once I was this is not it's a good story, but it doesn't answer your question. I'll come back to one that that is relevant and it's a proper success in a second. But one that really sticks out in my brain is a session that made me laugh and I still think about all the time, was with stick insects. I love stick insects. They're incredibly charismatic. They're incredibly interesting. They're incredibly bizarre. And as I kind of hinted at it before, I kind of would sit them on my hand and they'd walk around and they'd kind of crawl over the back and sometimes up your arm and kind of, you try and keep them as still and as kind of calm as possible, but they'd often go for a wander just because they were curious about what was going on. And there was one day that we had a stick insect who was huge, 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 huge. and we called her Big Bertha. And Bertha would sit on your arm, and there was one day she just started chewing on an arm hair, and I was there talking kind of like, oh, and this is how they reproduce and this is what they do. And all of a sudden, usually they kind of nibble on arm hairs until they realized, oh, this is a hair, this is nothing good for me. But she just kept going. And so it got to the point where she, I could feel like her chewing on skin. And I was like, but I kept, I was like, what? But you know that we were like, I'm in front of an audience. We're going to stand here. We're going to complete the presentation and it'll be fine. And eventually she did stop chewing and it wasn't that sore and it didn't leave a mark and it wasn't bad or whatever it was. But that's one that sticks out in my head of being like, that's a memorable session. Yes. In terms of like sessions that were memorable being huge successes, I think recently there's been a couple that kind of have sprung to mind. I recently helped at Edinburgh Zoo helping their kind of CAT program, which stands for Conservation Action Team. And they were kind of building these like pine hoverfly lagoons where basically these hoverflies and a lot of these kind of strange little things, they like to lay their eggs and kind of reproduce and grow in mushy, horrible, for us anyway, rotting stuff. So we had jars and we were filling them with kind of different bits and pieces of kind of like dirt and maybe some leaves and some different things, and then getting some little bit of water in just to get the kind of process of kind of it going a bit grim and gross and making it a nice reproductive spot for creepy crawlies. So that was a good success because it didn't just kind of give the kids maybe this creative project to do. It got them thinking about, we're shoving stuff in a jar, but we're shoving stuff in a jar with purpose. And they started thinking about kind of like, oh, like if I was the insect that was going to be kind of using this as my home, what would I put into it? What would I kind of want to do? What would I want to kind of live in? What would I want to eat? What would I? And that kind of was good because it made them think about, oh, I am the insect. I am the creepy crawly. I am this thing. So that I would say was a success. I guess the bug safaris that we've been kind of talking about, the kind of creepy crawly, whatever you want to call it, safari, mini beast safari, I think is what we went with because it kind of demystifies the terms, because when you call things creepy, it makes kids scared of them. But if you say mini beast safari, they love it. Those were big successes because it gave the kids a chance to explore. It gave a chance, like in a usual handling session or a usual kind of insect, or it's in a very kind of contained space where they're sat down as normal in a classroom, as normal, kind of being presented with this thing almost as normal. And that does give benefits and thrills in itself, but having them out in nature and able to run around and find these animals where they're meant to be, that was a huge success. I think they loved it. They just would love stuff like that, where they could go and they could see, oh, this is where a shield bug might hang around. This is where whatever this might be is. And then you'd get them thinking like, okay, well, we've looked at these creatures in the garden. Has anyone noticed any birds flying around? Has anyone noticed any kind of frogs or newts or kind of all of these little things? And get them think then about connectiveness to other parts of nature. Get them maybe to think about camouflage, all sorts of stuff like that, where you kind of, you're in this outdoor space, you get them excited, they get that kind of connection with the real place, and then they kind of get the wider picture as well with the rest of the ecosystem. I'd say those were big successes. I don't know, I guess, yeah, anything like that, I think those are kind of the ones that stick out in recent memory as being impactful. Yeah. I do kind of still remember, because even when I was a child, we would go to the same aquarium that I worked at, and it was a local kind of setup, and the one that has stuck with me since then is kind of having these rock pool encounters where you would see the kind of crabs and starfish, and kind of you get to see them up close. So those again are kind of experiential things where you get to see these animals up close, you maybe get to touch them. So those are the ones that impacted me, and I hope those kind of continued that and helped to inspire more kids to kind of love them. And I hope now there's still kids going and being inspired. But yeah, I don't know if, again, I kind of rambled about several things that I think are successes, but you know,
like I said, I think rambling's to be encouraged, and it's because what I kind of like to do, and you've started to hint towards it, because you're talking about impact and you're talking about yourself, and I can't help but see that as part of that, those experiences you had and watching, you mentioned like Planet Earth and stuff, and where that's led you. And I was wondering, as someone who's been an educator, but as someone who loves conservation, to what degree is that a connected thing in the sense that, like, so do you think that education and the demystification of animal lives and talking to children and things like that, is that part of conservation as a kind of broader idea?
There's a quote that I guess it's thrown around literally every time somebody brings up education and conservation. And it's a quote by Babadjoum, I believe is how it's pronounced. I'm unsure of the exact pronunciation. And they said, it's something along the lines of, in the end, we will conserve only what we love. We will love only what we understand, and we will understand only what we are taught. And I right. think it's a quote that's thrown around a lot in conservation education for being like, well, you have to be taught something and you have to experience something and you have to be kind of around something to love it. And I do, I guess, mm-hmm. I would disagree in a sense that you don't have to be taught something necessarily to love it. But I do think you have to experience it. I do think you have to kind of get this connection with it. Yeah, and I think that's the benefit of organizations that I've worked for, things like the garden and an aquarium and a zoo, is that they present these opportunities for people to become connected with nature, and they present these opportunities for people to learn in a way that they never would be able to normally. And I think it's easy for a lot of people to take for granted, if they have gardens or they have kind of green spaces around them, that oh, everyone has this. Everyone will get to experience nature all the time. Why do we need these things? Not everybody does. Not everybody has these gardens or plots of land around them where they get to see nature. And even if they do have green spaces, they could just be someone, the council's gone out and they've planted a square meter of grass and gone, it's a park. So we do have to have these kind of organizations to form these connections. And so, yeah, I guess, getting back to the main point, I suppose, yes, I do think it's very important that people experience nature. And I do think it's very important that people get out there and get to see these things. And I think almost we've talked a lot about kids throughout the conversation, but I do think it goes beyond that. I think environmental education is not something that you should do up until the age of 18 and then give up on it because, going outside and playing is for kids. I think everyone can be involved and everyone can find something they love and everyone can find something they kind of are passionate about in nature and want to protect and want to thrive and learn from. And I guess connectedness is important, but it's also ensuring that that connectedness doesn't just last a year, doesn't just last a childhood, but it lasts a whole lifetime. It lasts forever and ever and ever. I guess that would be, that's a whole other probably podcast where we have to speculate how do we keep that connection going. But yes. If you want to speculate about that, I can do wildly, but we'll see.
Well, do you know what? I mean, since starting to do this podcast, you know, I always liked invertebrates, but I kind of got back into them after sort of a break, as it were, and started reading more about invertebrates. And then I decided I wanted to do to make that meaningful for me, because I'm not an academic, I can't study them in that sense. So I started doing this and talking to people and making this podcast. And in doing so, I've realised that my sense of what it meant to be interested in invertebrate life and my sense of, and nature more broadly, frankly, having that diversity of voices in my ears, be it the people that I talk to or just engaging with kind of nature adjacent communities online and things like that, has really opened my eyes to like complexities and difficult subjects, and it's been really rewarding to engage with those things. But like you said, I didn't know that world existed. I didn't know there were people out there having these conversations, and I didn't know about all these things. And so to be given access to that has been a real privilege, and to be able to learn from people has been a real privilege. And I mean, you know what? Here's a really nice little connection now, because now we can say, if you want to learn more about conservation, where would you recommend people go, Jack?
Well, I guess before I do some horrific self-promo, I would recommend just going onto a local message board or going onto a local Facebook group or going onto whatever it is and searching for local conservation-y things that are going on around you would be my number one port of call, because then you can do actually meaningful things and you can go and meet people who are also passionate and learn from them directly. Would be a great starting point. But if you're looking
what do we really mean?
Yeah. If you're looking for more educational, interesting podcasts, I would recommend Pangolin, the conservation podcast. It's my show, which, while it is named after the wonderful and weird pangolin, it is a celebration of all species and stories that are, like the pangolin, underappreciated, underrepresented, underspoken about, underexplored. And so we have kind of celebrated conservation stories from every corner of the world, every kind of... we've tried to have diverse voices, we've tried to have kind of diverse stories. So even just in the last few episodes, we talked about things like the Wollemi pine and how it came back from extinction. We've talked about koalas, we've talked about archer fish, we've talked about how giraffes are going under going through a kind of silent extinction. We've talked about giant armadillos and tapirs, and I'm trying to think of invertebrates that we covered. We did a whole episode with Felix Rowan Young from the Chester Zoo Youth Board, who talked about some of the invertebrates of Chester Zoo, which was fascinating and fantastic and wonderful. And so, yeah, we've talked about all sorts of these topics that are kind of underappreciated, underexplored, underloved conservation stories. And that is Pangolin, the conservation podcast, available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this. It will also be available there. So, yeah, you can go and find them. Find it and kind of have a stream and see. Yeah, hopefully you enjoy it. If you've enjoyed listening to me, it's a lot of me rambling, so you can go and check it out.
And people, yeah. I very much recommend people do that and go and enjoy that. As a conservationist, and as we kind of wrap up, I'm always interested in this with people that are interested in your field. I don't want to sway you, but let's not end on a complete downer. But as someone that's interested in conservation, how are you feeling? Are you an optimistic conservationist, or, you know, what's your sense of things?
So I think my kind of thesis statement on conservation and my kind of standpoint on everything that's going on in the world is that, yes, it is hard and it's sad sometimes to be a conservationist. And at the end of the day, sometimes you do look at a story and you think, why is the world like this? I want to, like... I wish I could change it. How can I change it? And you raise all these questions and you kind of start thinking, oh, is it worth it? And all this stuff, and you spiral and you get into these dark places. Don't do that. And if you do start to do that, what you need to do, coming from kind of my perspective and what I do, is take a step back and think about the fact that everything we do is good. Everything you do as a conservationist, even if you do a little thing, even if you talk to one person about an animal, even if you kind of help recycle just a little bit of plastic, everything you do matters and is a good thing. We are constantly fighting and looking to protect wonderful, amazing ecosystems. We're constantly kind of doing good, fantastic, wonderful work, and we shouldn't lose the joy of that fantastic work just because sometimes there is bad stories. If we lost joy every time there was a hard story, it would be so hard to keep going. So don't focus on the bad, focus on the success. And if you do want to focus on the bad, don't focus on it being negative, focus on the things that we can learn and take forward and try and create success from. Because yeah, I think that's the way you've got to be to be a conservationist now, is to really focus on the good, and use the negative to your advantage. It would be my statement on the whole thing. I don't know. That was all very kind of perfectly phrased. I feel like I phrased that quite well and quite powerfully until the end when I didn't know how to finish it. And then I went, yeah, cool. So
that is how we finished it. That's fine. You've spoken beautifully. It's a pleasure to think about it. And on behalf of the animals, if I may do so, thank you. And on behalf of the natural world, because, you know, people like yourself who are doing these things it's wonderful work, and I'm glad there's people like you who are out there doing it. And if you want to hear more about that, yeah, do go and listen to Pangolin, a conservation podcast, alongside mine, a podcast with a subtitle, which is, I'm sure, a great help when it comes to kind of, what's the phrase? Search engine optimization?
That was my hope, because originally I was going to just like go with Pangolin, and I was like, if you search Pangolin on like Google, as much as they are underappreciated and strange and bizarre, you still get a heck of a lot of results. So you have to add that little specification of kind of like, oh, we do. This is what we actually talk about, not just pangolins, not just like whatever it is. We're there for all the weird, underappreciated things.
Well, as a fan of weird and underappreciated things, I think that's wonderful. Jack, thank you so much for speaking to me today. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope that people do come away from this with some thoughts about, if you're an educator, if you have children or have children in your life, you know, things that you can do and ways we can discuss things. And if you are someone who's just interested and wants to know more about what you do, there's places to go and do so. So thank you so much, Jack.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me. I guess one last message to any adults or parents out there would be, try and demystify the invertebrates for yourself. If you don't appear scared and you don't appear nervous about them, your kids will be a lot less scared of them as well. So go out there and, adults, you're, go out there and love some insects or some creepy crawlies or some weird things. Go out there and do it, because it's important. And yeah, thank you so much again for having me. Thank you.
Wonderful. What a wonderful proactive message to end on. Grubbing the Filth was written and produced by me, Tom Sharp, with music by Will Hutton. My thanks again to Jack Baker. You can find Grubbing the Filth on Twitter at GITF Podcast or Instagram at Grubbing the Filth. You can also email grubbingthefilth@gmail.com. Thank you.